foot six above sea level. I grab my mic because I like to take it to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground. We bring the truth to places truth is never heard before.
Thank you for listening. A public affair. I'm your host, Karma Chavez. I'm filling in today for John Quinlan. And we are going to be having a fun show, I think, today. We have Dace, an engineer, and we also have Dean out front helping us out. So many have been touting the SB 744, the Border Security Economic Opportunity and Immigration Modernization Act, as a wonderful nearly 1,200-page compromise on immigration reform. But others, of course, are adamantly opposed to it for the increase in border militarization and the difficulty to actually access the so-called pathway to citizenship. On the militarization point, in a June 26 press release, Coalición de Derechos Humanos and others had this to say about the new bill pushed through the Senate last week. They said, "Make no mistake, this bill will lead to more deaths on the border. It is bad public policy, and it is a giant step backward for our communities and for many immigrant families. Our communities and families deserve better, and if this is the best that the Senate can offer, we feel that our only option is to withdraw our support and demand that Congress begin again on crafting a genuine reform bill." Others like the No Name Collective and the Moratorium on Deportations out of Chicago have been educating communities about the problems with the bill, including a video that they've put out called Immigration Reform 101, Unmasking Senate Bill 744. And I want us to listen to just a short clip of this and see what it has to say here about the pathway to citizenship. Do we have that queued up?
All the hype around the so-called path to citizenship includes very little information about the actual provisions of the bill. The path described by the bill is not as simple as the media or as some promoters of the bill will have us believe. It is actually a series of steps. For each step, there is a complicated application process which acts as a barrier, determining who can pass on to the next step and who is rejected or excluded. The path looks something like this. People who qualify can apply for RPI. If they receive it, after 6 years, they must apply to renew RPI. After 4 years or more, if other conditions are met, people can apply for a green card. And then, after at least 3 years, people can apply for citizenship. At each step of the process, the barriers are more and more complicated. More and more people are excluded and unable to move down the path.
So as you can hear, you get a sense there of what some people are saying about how complex just this one part of it is. So to help us work through some of this opposition and also some of the complexities of the Senate bill and discuss what might happen in the House of Representatives, we have a couple of folks from No More Deaths, a humanitarian organization based in Southern Arizona, founded in 2004, whose mission is to end death and suffering in the U.S.-Mexico borderlands. No More Deaths operates on the premise of civil initiative, the conviction that people of conscience must work openly and in community to uphold fundamental human rights. Today we have with us Jeff Boyce and also Lila Pine. Jeff lives in Tucson, and Lila's a Madison resident and lives the other part of the year in Tucson. I can't blame you there. Jeff and Lila, welcome to a we don't have Jeff yet. Lila, welcome to A Public Affair.
Thank you very much.
And I'm imagining you're happier to be in Madison right now than Tucson, given the temperatures down there.
Yeah, the temps have been like in the 120s for the last month or so. It's been, you know, unprecedented. And that means lots of deaths of migrants trying to cross the border.
Absolutely. I think that's sort of why I wanted to sort of ease us into this conversation, talking about the temperature, because, you know, Arizona's so hot, but a lot of people don't think about the real human impacts of that for folks who are crossing in the desert. And that's why No More Deaths began as an organization. I wonder if you could tell us just a little bit about what No More Deaths is and what you do.
Yeah. We started going to Tucson about 10 years ago, you know, for the winter and into the spring. And we connected with No More Deaths and its sister organization, the Samaritans, And I started volunteering first for the Samaritans. We call them the SAMs. And they go out on a daily basis. They do day trips out into the desert, bringing food, water, and medical care out to migrants who were left behind by the coyotes, the people smugglers, left behind to die when they couldn't keep up walking at a rapid pace with the group. And then I guess basically in the summers, because the temperatures are always in triple digits and sometimes really quite deadly, that's the time when we have most of the deaths or severe illnesses. And the deaths are mostly caused by severe dehydration, heat stroke, intestinal problems that, you know, from drinking, you know, the only water they can find here and there might be in a cow trough, and, you know, all kinds of bacteria and diseases in that water. And then they get very ill. Their kidneys and liver shut down totally, and then they die. They also often die from severe blisters. They have to walk about 4 or 5 days on foot, about 81 miles across the Sonoran Desert in Arizona, on foot, and they often have severe blisters that are so extreme and painful that they get those people also get left behind by the coyotes to die. So it started out purely as humanitarian aid, with No More Deaths bringing in mostly college students, but also professors and people, you know, regular working folks, in the summers. And they opened a summer camp out in the middle of the desert, with tents and sleeping bags and whatnot, and had college students and others from all over the country. We've also had a group of 15 human rights activists from Germany come together to volunteer in the desert to save lives. We've had a human rights attorney from Australia come. She just found us online and came. With this camping program, which No More Deaths has now expanded to pretty much year-round, we not only were able to save many lives and help many people who were severely ill in the desert, but we also got to do a lot of hands-on education. It's very much an experiential education, and, you know, experience for the people who come out there. And then when they go back home to their hometowns, their states, their countries, you know, we give them materials to educate other people, to do presentations in universities or churches or any, you know, unions, any mm-hmm. kind of group. While we were bandaging people's feet, and No More Deaths started in 2004. We're going to be commemorating our 10th year starting in January. We started listening to the stories of the migrants, of what they had gone through while they were in the custody of U.S. Border Patrol in these short-term immigration facilities that are meant to keep people for only 72 hours mm-hmm. before deporting them or sending them to be criminalized en masse through what's called Operation Streamline. We started expanding, and we started documenting all the different human rights abuses that we were hearing about from these migrants. Mm-hmm. And I should say to Midwestern listeners who get confused with the term migrant as it's used in the Southwest, which is different. Here we, of course, think of migrant farm workers. And in the Southwest, as you know, we use the term migrant for anyone who has migrated from one country to another. Mm-hmm. So, it, you know, here, I guess we'd use the word immigrants for that. But but just so people know, when I say migrant, that's those are the people migrating who I'm talking about. We started listening to their stories, and they were horrific. I mean, the human rights abuses, you know, they're everything from 3 days of deprivation of food, water, and medical care to, you know, being beaten by gangs of Border Patrol agents, sexual harassment of the women migrants, just a long, long list of things. We started putting this together into a report, which came out in 2008, and we have a wonderful progressive congressman down in Tucson, Raul Grijalva, who set up a trip for some of our people to go to Washington, D.C. He set up a briefing session with Congress for us and contacts in the administration in 2008. Different administration. And so we started getting the word out. We did a much deeper report and study called A Culture of Cruelty, human rights violations against migrants by U.S. Border Patrol agents who have them in their custody. By the way, another thing is they don't get any beds to sleep on or even a thin 2-inch mattress. They sleep on the floor. 100 of them are crowded into these facilities, into cells that are meant to hold only 44 people, and they push in 100, and they have to sleep on top of each other. Just horrible conditions.
Absolutely.
So we got into more of the human rights aspect through these reports, and people who are interested can look up our more recent report, which took us 3 years to document human rights abuses after we and some partner agencies of ours interviewed almost 13,000 migrants who had just been deported, and we interview them on the Mexico side of Nogales, Sonora. The report is amazing, and you can find it on cultureofcruelty.org, O-R-G. And we started getting national recognition for our work after that. Maria Hinojosa, award-winning producer with PBS, had her people interview us as, you know, some of our volunteers were working on the Mexico side of Nogales. And, you know, we started out only working in Nogales, Arizona. But, you know, we now very much do work with people who are just been deported.
I'm going to jump in here real quick. If you're just joining us on A Public Affair, I'm your host, Karma Chavez, filling in for John Quinlan. And we're talking with folks from No More Deaths, a humanitarian organization in Tucson, Arizona, about militarization of the border, migrants, as well as the Senate bill that's just been approved and is heading on to the House. If you want to join the conversation, you can give us a call here at 256-2001. You can also call toll-free at 866-899-WORT. You can tweet me at Queer Migrations, or you can also go to the A Public Affair Facebook page and post a question up there, and I'll get to that too. So lots of ways to get involved in the conversation here. I want to go ahead and introduce our other guest today, who is Jeff Boyce. And Jeff, are you there?
Yeah, I am. Yep.
Hey, Jeff. I wonder if you could just talk briefly. You know, Lila's painted a really great picture for us there about all the horrific things on the border and how No More Deaths as an organization has evolved. How did you get involved with No More Deaths?
Sure. Well, I first got involved with No More Deaths in the summer of 2004, really just as a short-term volunteer. I came down to southern Arizona for a week. And it was really a life-changing experience. The people that I met and just coming into contact with that reality of the border, you know. And so one thing led to another, and 10 years later, you know, I'm still involved. But of course, the problem hasn't gone away. In many ways, it's simply gotten worse.
And when you say it's gotten worse, I mean, that's that kind of goes against what we hear in the media, because all we hear in the media is, well, that there are less crossers now, and so all the border militarization is working. So what do you mean it's gotten worse?
Well, certainly crossing has gone down, and that's a result of a number of factors, the economy prime among them. In fact, we're seeing, you know, this narrative that crossing is down over the long term. That's true, but in 2012 and 2011 there were increases over sort of the nadir in 2011. So it's going back up, and that's sort of what we could expect. As the economy recovers, more people are going to try crossing again. But alongside, you know, that long term trend of the numbers going down has actually been a steady increase in the proportion of people who have died in the desert, the proportion of crossers who've died. So the numbers themselves, the absolute number, has remained relatively steady. Each year there are about 200 bodies recovered from the Arizona desert. And these are simply the people who are encountered and identified. There are, you know, many, many hundreds and even thousands of others who go missing on the journey. These are very remote places, as Lila's been talking about, where people get lost, run into trouble. Oftentimes they can't find help. And so we know there are many other people who have actually died but aren't part of, the tally that we're able to account for. But the point being that the absolute numbers have remained consistent for about the last decade, but as the number of, you know, overall crossers has declined, the proportion of people who are dying has gone up, and there have been a number of academic studies now that have found a direct correlation between U.S. spending on border enforcement, border militarization, and the number of deaths that we see out in the desert. So, we're very concerned about these border security provisions, you know, so-called security provisions in the Senate bill. And we have every reason to believe that if they go into effect, we'll see a possibly dramatic spike in the number of people who die on the border.
Well, and I want to follow up a little bit here on this question of security and militarization, because these terms get used a lot, and usually at the government level we hear border security, but people on the border talk about border militarization. So I wonder if you could just say a little bit about what you mean by that term, militarization, either one of you.
Yeah. Sure. Well, the Border Patrol themselves now describe themselves as a paramilitary organization, and the discourse and mentality of the supposed war on terror have completely permeated the organization. After September 11th, the organization redefined its priority mission to one of combating terrorists. Despite the fact that there's, you know, no evidence that any transnational terrorist organization has ever tried to use the border to cross into the United States, and there's good reason to believe that, you know, they have many other options available to them if that even were a plausible threat, other than, you know, walking in the desert for 4 or 5 days. But we see the Border Patrol increasingly taking up this kind of military logic. And in the hiring search that's happened in the last 10 years or so, you know, they're talking about doubling the size of the Border Patrol now. Well, the Border Patrol has already doubled. In fact, it's doubled twice in the last 15 years. And a lot of these people have come directly out of combat theaters in Iraq and Afghanistan. And in addition to the individual agents, you see more and more security contractors, really defense contractors, making their way into the Homeland Security market and using military technologies designed for combat theaters here in the United States through this sort of context of border security. So the Border Patrol are now using Predator B drones. They have a total of 10 that are deployed on the northern and southern border, We have all kinds of different kinds of surveillance technology in addition to the drones that are being used. And again, it's the very same companies that are involved in providing these assets to the Army, the military, and to the Department of Homeland Security. So to call it militarization is not hyperbole. It's not overblown. I mean, through Homeland Security, through the Border Patrol, we do see a militarization of law enforcement activity in U.S. communities, and it's precisely through the incorporation of military logic, military rhetoric, military personnel, and military technologies. Really, this is of course really problematic and dangerous for a lot of reasons, not least being it leads to a great deal of abuse. A great deal of violence. The Border Patrol themselves have been directly involved in 20 killings in the last 2 years, mm-hmm. None of which have resulted in any kind of prosecution or accountability.
In every case, they were unarmed. I mean, the victims of the shootings were totally unarmed.
That's right, yeah. Mm. Yeah, the victims were unarmed. In many of these circumstances, the victims were merely... there's no allegation that they were involved in any misconduct, and these are both U.S. citizens and Mexican citizens and Guatemalan citizens, and many of whom weren't even migrants. They're residents of the border region, and mm-hmm. this is really one of the biggest threats. This is one of the biggest impacts of this militarization and of the threatened, unprecedented ramp-up of this militarization in the current congressional proposal. One of the biggest impacts is on border communities themselves. Of course, those who pay the highest price are the migrants who die out in the desert and their families and loved ones, of course. But we also see a tremendous impact on U.S. communities in the border region. Overwhelmingly Latino. We see rampant incidences of racial profiling. Mm-hmm. People have to prove their go through checkpoints and prove their citizenship just to get to school, to work, to go to the doctor. These are everyday realities for people who live in the border region, and it's alarming, it's really something that ought to be a part of any immigration reform agenda, but unfortunately, instead, what we see is this current proposal will make all of these realities much, much worse.
Well, I'm going to jump in right here because I think we have a caller on the air. Caller, could you state your first name and your question?
Yeah, this is Jim, and I just like to say that I think this is one facet of the industrialized military complex that we were warned about. And I'll take the comment off the air. Thank you.
Thanks. So what about that, Lila or Jeff, that this is just part of the military-industrial complex that Eisenhower warned us of so many years ago?
It very much is, but it's also mixed with racism and xenophobia in this case. The only people who will benefit from the $38 billion allocated under this proposed bill, allocated to further militarization of the border, are those huge corporations that have benefited in Iraq and Afghanistan. And as Jeff said, we get a number of people being hired by Border Patrol at starting salary of $60,000 with nothing but a GED. And many of them are coming straight back from the wars in the Middle East. And I've talked to Border Patrol union personnel who say, yeah, these folks come, they've already suffered PTSD and they no longer train us. They only spend one-fifth the time they used to spend, management of Border Patrol used to spend in training us. And then on top of that, we are pressured. We're given quotas. We've got to pick up so many people in the desert. ICE has to deport so many people per day.
ICE, Immigration Customs Enforcement.
Yeah, right, exactly. And they are pressured to, quote, capture more and more undocumented immigrants. Well, you know, that leads to the racial profiling, which, you know, there have been numbers of cases in the news lately about how many U.S. citizens who are Latino and quote, look Latino, being deported mm-hmm. when they were born here in this country. People who have been here legally and are permanent legal residents being deported. And, you know, the injustice here is that they don't get any hearing or trial or anything. They're just picked up and deported. And, you know, well, if we made a mistake, that's just the price we have to pay, right?
Well, and this is why, I mean, these kinds of problems are actually going to be exacerbated with this current bill, which is why Presente, National Network of Immigrant and Refugee Rights, Coalición de Derechos Humanos, a number of other organizations are opposing this bill, because this is currently what's happening, but
right.
we're going to see expansion.
You know, I mean, there's a headline I saw from one of those groups that, you know, border militarization, border enforcement is not immigration reform. The thing that bothers people the most, that troubles folks, migrants, the most, is forced separation of families that results from each deportation. Each deportation, you know, gives criminal status to the immigrant and turns their children who are left behind, they're forced to leave them behind in the U.S., it turns those children into orphans. And this forced family separation also is carried out at the border during the deportation process. When they're deporting a whole family and Border Patrol knows that it's a family that's all together, they will very deliberately deport them through totally different ports of entry, and they keep the migrants' cell phones, any money they were carrying, any personal belongings, so that they can't possibly find out where, you know, somebody's wife was deported through or where their children were deported through. We find out now that we work on the Mexico side of the border with just deported people that, the Border Patrol refuses to tell them when their immediate family member will be deported and through which state or, mm-hmm. you know. So you get, maybe the husband deported through Texas and the wife through Nogales, Arizona, and, you know, the children are separated out, et cetera. Mm-hmm. That's very much a human rights violation sure. right there, and it's the one that disturbs them the most. So the problem with all this enforcement isn't just that it's totally, you know, increased border enforcement funds are totally unnecessary. We could use the $38 billion instead of further militarization of the border. We could use that for health care or education or, you know, things in this country.
What do we say? So, you know, listeners in Wisconsin, maybe even liberal listeners, probably haven't spent much time on the border unless they've taken, a deliberate trip down there. So what do you say to people who ask the question, well, is the border insecure, I guess?
They already have 22 or 24,000 Border Patrol agents there. Just 10 years ago, there were only 3,000. They already have fences or border walls, through all of the safe areas where people used to be able to cross, and funneling them very deliberately. This is, you know, a government policy, funneling migrants through the most treacherous parts of the border, the mountains and the desert in Arizona, which also, you know, it's de- called their policy of deterrence, we call it deterrence by death. Mm-hmm. And that's why we have so many bodies we discover, you know, maybe months later or years after the person died.
Well, and in fact, even in 1993 or 1994 with the Southwest Border Strategy, the then Immigration Naturalization Service Commissioner Doris Meisner actually said, you know, nobody's going to want to walk through that desert. So some of them will die and then everybody else will know.
Yeah. And she's been interviewed lately saying, you know, she was dead wrong on that and she thinks it was a big mistake, you know, to have that kind of policy, because what didn't factor in here was how desperate conditions were in Mexico and Central America, the countries these folks are coming from, mm-hmm. how desperate their situation was, you know, with the impact of NAFTA and CAFTA.
So the North American Free Trade Agreement and the Central America Free Trade Agreement.
Yes. Mm-hmm. You know, the impact of those U.S. trade policies was to really wipe out most of the agricultural jobs in Mexico and Central America that these people used to survive on. And so they were, you know, trying hard to find other work, couldn't do it. And so if they didn't cross here to find work, they would literally be sitting there watching their children die, starve to death, quite literally.
Right.
And so, you know, I think the U.S. thought, I don't think the government officials understood that risking your life crossing the border was a better option for these people
than watching your children starve.
Watching your children starve, exactly.
Well, and many people are separated from their loved ones here in the United States, too. And in fact, this has become an increasing problem with more and more deportations. You know, there have been record deportations under the Obama administration. Increasingly, the people we see on the border are people who, you know, their homes and their families and their jobs are in places like Detroit or Madison, Wisconsin, or, you know, Seattle, all over the United States. These are the people who, you know, end up being deported, and they're on the border, and they're desperate to cross again for that reason.
Yeah.
So this is an issue that actually it affects border communities disproportionately, but it affects, you know, the fabric of all of our communities in the United States. You know, when people are removed from their homes and families, this is the fate that awaits them, is having to cross through this gauntlet here on the border, and all of the violence and danger that comes with that.
Over the past few years, talked to several just deported migrants while I was in Nogales, Mexico, who came from Madison, Wisconsin. They told me which restaurants they worked at here, which family members they left behind here, who were, you know, no longer had a source of income here. Mm-hmm. And of course, Border Patrol and ICE will not allow people they're deporting right away to make any phone calls back to their families or even their child's school or daycare center to tell them what's happened and why they can't pick their children up that day.
Yeah. If you're just joining us here on A Public Affair, I'm your fill-in host today, Karma Chavez, and we're talking with Lila Pine and Jeff Boyce from No More Deaths in Tucson, Arizona. If you would like to join the conversation, you can give us a call at 256-2001 or 866-899-WORT. You can also tweet me at Queer Migrations, or you can ask a question on the Facebook page, A Public Affair, which is there, and I'll be checking that too.
If I could just finish up one thing about the enforcement provisions of the bill. The problem with this bill is that even if they had a good section on a clear path to citizenship, which the bill does not have, it's very weak and it's very difficult to be eligible under those rules. Even if they had a good section of the bill giving a path to citizenship, that doesn't get triggered until all the border enforcement provisions and the border militarization provisions are triggered. So, and some of those triggers are almost impossible to meet.
Well, and actually, that's right. I want us to have some time to actually talk through that. Exactly, what is the so-called pathway? I don't know. And Jeff, I don't know if you would want to walk us through that a little bit about what is this so-called pathway to citizenship in this bill?
Sure. Well, this has been of concern to us long before the Corker-Hoven border security stuff was added at the end of June. The Corker-Hoven stuff is the amendment that was adopted that would double the size of the Border Patrol and add, you know, a lot of these other provisions that I think border communities find especially troubling. But, you know, we found a lot of problems with the bill long before this border security stuff was added, and primarily having to do with the pathway to citizenship. When immigrant advocates claim that this bill will offer a pathway to citizenship for the 11 million estimated folks who are undocumented in this country, and a lot of immigrant advocacy groups have made that claim, it's very misleading, because in fact we know that as it stands right now, the bill would exclude first of all anybody who arrived in the country after December 31st, 2011. It actually expands the number of minor criminal infractions that can result in deportation, even for lawful permanent residents. You know, and this is a huge problem. This is a big part of what results in, you know, so many people being deported. The bill would exclude anybody who is unemployed over a 10-year period, right? The pathway to citizenship takes, 13 years to complete, and it's 10 years before you can even get a green card. And if during that 10 years you're unemployed for more than two consecutive months, or you earn less than 100% of the federal poverty line, your income is lower than 100% of the federal poverty line for any 1 year during that 10-year period, you can have your lawful status removed. And you can be deported. So people who studied this, say that this is likely to deny roughly 4 or 5 million, almost half of the people who, are undocumented in this country. And because of the increased enforcement that is also included in the bill, many of those folks will end up being deported. Have diminished opportunities to challenge their deportation. And so this bill, you know, while it does have some, certainly some people would qualify for legalization, some people would qualify for citizenship eventually, many, many people would not. I think that's really, it's really important to recognize that this so-called pathway to citizenship, which is the trade-off for all of the increased enforcement, was compromised from the start. So the idea that, advocates or Democrats in Congress are going to compromise even more, we really have to ask, how far is this going to go, right? I mean, how much worse will the bill get in the House? And what are people really willing to trade for this really already, really flawed pathway to citizenship?
So,
is it worth so many more deaths in the desert? Is it worth excluding millions of undocumented people who happen to be working people or poor? And we know that undocumented people are oftentimes among the most vulnerable and exploited in terms of the labor force, right? In terms mm-hmm. of working conditions, etc. And then they'll be further penalized under the framework in this bill. So that's very much of concern.
So just to clarify a couple of points here. So on the one hand, the original bill was there was about $5 billion going toward militarization projects. The last bill that the Senate actually passed, there's $38 billion. Those border security measures have to be in place before we even can consider a pathway to citizenship. That's correct?
Well, it's a question of semantics. So those provisions wouldn't have to be in place before the pathway to citizenship could begin. People could begin to register for the registered provisional immigration status, the RPI status. But they would have to be in place before that pathway could end in citizenship, right? So people could get on the pathway, but they couldn't actually get citizenship until a number of different provisions are completed, in including the border security issues.
In addition, a lot of the immigrants I work with here have told me that they, you know, people who are legal permanent residents have already waited 15 to 20 years to gain citizenship. And, you know, I had one friend who said that ICE had lost his paperwork three times over, you know, a course of 15 years. And he finally gave up. So, you know, we have to understand that the backlog of cases already handled by Department of Homeland Security is so far back. There's like a 20-year wait,
right,
even after you've made it to the position of legal permanent resident. And this RPI status is kind of vaguely described. It's a new category created by this bill, and it doesn't necessarily give them the right to work here legally.
Right.
So then they'd still be deported.
So it's a very ambiguous sort of status.
Yeah.
We actually have a call on the line. I think want to get us in here. Caller, could you state your first name and your question?
Hi. Sarah, turn it off, please. My name's Jeff.
Hi, Jeff.
There is a very basic cause for the problem as concerning the border, and that is a fellow named Clinton, when he was president, signed on and signed the NAFTA agreement.
Mm-hmm.
And what this resulted in was a clear avenue for the big food giants in the U.S. To export corn into Mexico at greatly reduced prices from what Mexican farmers could get in their towns from their produce. It put as many, nobody really knows, there's been no count, but the guesses are anywhere from 2.5 to 3 million Mexican farmers were put out of work because they couldn't compete with this subsidized corn coming from Archer Daniels, etc. And I think people need to understand that part of the guilty people in this process, and I look on it as murder, the deaths in the desert are just the tip of the iceberg.
Mm-hmm.
That's a lousy metaphor for people dying from incredible heat. But the name is Clinton, and folks mm-hmm. should think twice before voting for Democrats named Clinton, because their creation and their signing off on NAFTA is a huge part of the problem. And where the hell else are people going to go if they can't sell the produce? And it isn't just that. It's also that there are rather large tracts mm-hmm. in Mexico that are no longer in produce.
Yeah.
They are just barren, and there's nobody can afford to plant.
Yeah,
this is a crazy situation.
It's a great.
And it comes from Washington. Thanks for the program. This is a really desperate situation, and I'm glad you're pointing a finger at it.
Thanks, Jeff, so much for the call. I think very well put there in terms of NAFTA being a large part of the contemporary situation, and also there's nothing dealing with the question of free trade, of course, in this proposed bill.
Yeah. If we could put some of these billions of dollars into helping rebuild the agricultural system and renegotiating NAFTA and CAFTA and creating jobs in Mexico, we wouldn't, well, not that we need a wall, we don't, but, you know, if we could have done that instead of spending billions of dollars on trying to wall up 2,000 miles of border, we wouldn't even need to be here with this conversation.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Well, and I want to. We have about six minutes or so left here in the show, and I want us to have a chance to hear from you about What people can be doing with regard to this bill? What are the kinds of things that No More Deaths is doing, either to advocate to folks in the House, or what kind of the next steps are here? I don't know, Jeff, if you want to start with that.
Sure. No More Deaths opposes this bill in its current incarnation because we believe that the consequences for border communities and for the country as a whole really outweigh the benefits. And we don't think that it's worth trading off, potentially thousands more deaths on the border and a pathway to citizenship that excludes millions in order to get some of the good provisions that are in the bill. And there are some good provisions that are in the bill. In terms of concrete steps forward, we are encouraging our representatives in Congress who are Democrats, not to support this bill until the border security provisions, which, let's remember, these were thrown in at the last minute by the Senate, negotiated behind closed doors without the input of advocacy groups, without the input of border residents. So we want these removed, and we think that the Democrats should not agree to, work with Republicans in the House on passing a bill until those things are removed.
Can I jump in on that real quick, though, Joe?
It's really important that we understand that the issue around immigration in this country is a civil rights and a human rights issue. We have millions of people in our communities who are subject to all kinds of abuse and exploitation and everyday fear and precarity because of their undocumented status. Human rights and civil rights are not subject to compromise. Dr. King said a right deferred is a right denied. So that's our position, is that we ought to be principled in what we demand in terms of immigration reform and the fundamental tenets of what needs to be in a genuine reform bill cannot be subject to compromise.
I want to jump in a bit, though, on that, because it seems at this point, right, moving into the House, it's only bound to get worse. And so, it's sort of what you're saying, kind of utopian in a sense.
It's not a good situation. It's not been a good situation on the border or for immigrants in this country for a long time. But fundamentally, we've been hearing for the last, 10 years, secure the border first. If you secure the border first, then we'll talk about legalization and a pathway to citizenship. At this point, border communities in the U.S. are among the safest in the country. Homeland Security does not even have a framework for evaluating what border security would mean. They literally don't have a metric or any set of concrete criteria that would indicate whether the border is or is not, or is or is not more secure than it was, based on any given action they take. So, this is expanded in this bill. This bill formalizes, institutionalizes this paradigm of quote unquote securing the border first before people who desperately need relief, who desperately need an improvement in their situation can qualify for it, and we think that that's simply wrongheaded, and it won't work. That's what we've been pursuing for the last 10 years, and the consequences of it have been a disaster. So, we do hope that we certainly are not going to support this bill unless it is improved in the House. The politics suggest that I mean, you're right, that is unlikely, and so I think that. Advocates need to also start thinking beyond simply, August or this fall, and whether the House is going to pass something or not. Because as we've been talking about, whether this bill passes or not, a lot of the problems that are in our communities, a lot of the problems that affect immigrants are going to continue. And they're not going to be addressed by this bill, and we're deluding ourselves if we think that they are. And so we need to continue to think about strategies to challenge this, whether they be through grassroots mobilization, civil disobedience, or litigation.
Great. Go ahead, Lila.
Yeah, just wanted to give people in the Midwest an idea of, the current state at the border. you know, which is supposed to be, according to the Republicans, so unsafe for us. The city at the border on the Arizona side, Nogales, has a death rate that is very, very tiny. Has a civilian murder rate that is very, very low. And you know, there's absolutely no reason to further militarize there. However, if you compare that rate to Milwaukee, the city of Milwaukee, you know, according to this bill, we should have, you know, armed guards and walls built totally around the city of Milwaukee, which has a much, much higher death rate. And is, you know, that death rate is constantly, murder rate. We're talking about crime statistics. You know, that murder rate is growing each year in Milwaukee. You know, so Milwaukee is far more unsafe than Arizona is.
We're going to have to leave it right there. Jeff and Lila, thanks a lot for being here today.
Thank you.
And we've been talking with Jeff Boyce and Lila Pine, who are members of No More Deaths, which is in Tucson, Arizona, about the Senate Bill 744. And you can find more information at cultureofcruelty.org.
Or nomoredeaths.org.
Or nomoredeaths.org. And I'm Karma Chavez, and you've been listening to A Public Affair. I grab the mic because I like to take you to another mental level. Low power frequency radio modulation. The big sound from underground, another pirate station. We bring the truth to places.